I was trying so hard to be clean cut and look like someone who has their life together sure. that I actually became somebody who is clean cut and has their life together.
This is Caregiver Storyteller, produced by Caring Kind, the heart of Alzheimer's caregiving. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Caregiver Storyteller, a storytelling podcast about Alzheimer's and dementia caregiving. I'm Chris Doucette, and I'll be interviewing caregivers to get their stories about Alzheimer's and dementia caregiving. Occasionally, I'll also interview the authors, advocates, researchers, healthcare professionals, and people with Alzheimer's and dementia to hear their stories, too. So, are you ready? Here we go.
My name is Sue Funk. I live in Astoria, New York, and my mother had Alzheimer's. She passed away from it.
I'm sorry to hear that. How did the diagnosis come to be? What was the process there?
It took a while to stick. In 07, her doctor, that was also my doctor, we shared a primary care physician in Long Island, mm-hmm. Told her she had a lot of vertigo issues, mm-hmm. and she was starting to forget things, and she thought it was part of the vertigo. She was like, I just feel disoriented all the time. And so her doctor did a test on her, did some scans, and she said she felt that she had early onset Alzheimer's. And my mother got so mad, she walked out, and she didn't go to a doctor for a year or so, I think. And then she finally got some second opinions, and a lot of opinions and a lot of scans, and it kept coming up the same thing. There was just a long period of disbelief and not wanting to accept the diagnosis.
Yeah.
I knew as soon as the doctor said that, because I had kind of felt that there were little bit of signs. You know, I think it's become kind of a common trend of like people over, I would say probably like 55, are always like, oh, it's a senior moment. It's a senior mm-hmm. moment. Mm-hmm. There were more and more of them, and there was more things where I just noticed her stopping in her speech a lot, mm-hmm. And giving up certain things like reading or crossword puzzles. It would start just being Sudoku. Mm-hmm. We went to a lot of different doctors, and she and my stepfather were born again Christian. Mm-hmm. And they really just wanted to pray on it instead of getting a lot of active treatment. Mm-hmm. And that set her back and really increased the, it kind of, basically, she, after her diagnosis, she only lived 10 more years, and she declined very rapidly.
Were you living with her at the time of diagnosis or right prior?
No, I had moved out about 3 years, 4 years before that. Yeah, I went to college. I've always lived on Long Island. I mean, Astoria is technically on Long Island. No mm-hmm. one wants to admit Brooklyn and Queens are part of Long Island. But I'm originally from Nassau County, from Garden City. And so I lived at college, though. I went to college at Hofstra University, 10 minutes away from home. Mm-hmm.
So you were close enough to still have a kind of regular contact yes. with your mom, and you could still see this happening on a real-time basis.
Oh, yeah. And that was also difficult because I'm the youngest of four, and my siblings are all on the East Coast but far away. Mm. And they didn't see her or speak to her, I think, as much as I had been. And so they didn't take it as seriously for a while either. I feel like I was really the one constantly sounding the alarm and being like, we have to do something. We have to get, you know, a healthcare proxy was something that I really, really wanted. Early on, as soon as like there was acceptance, I went to a doctor's appointment with my brother and my stepfather and my mom. We all went in the same room just to like all be on the same page. And there's a common test in Alzheimer's where like a doctor will name four things and then they like say a few sentences and then they go back to the patient and they'll be like, name those four things. And like, my mom looked at that doctor like, you never named anything to me. You're crazy. Mm-hmm. And I think that finally made my brother realize. And my sister was kind of on board. I think everyone, like, and my other brother just kind of didn't want to deal with it, which is understandable too. You know, I think it's a hard thing to face, but it was just really interesting and difficult at times because I was there for years just being like, guys, this is getting worse. Like, she's not getting the help she needs. She's not doing what she needs. Like, I kept reading all the research and being like, you know, she's supposed to be seeing friends. She's supposed to be going out. And she kept isolating herself. And my stepfather as well was kind of complicit in that. They really like to just be together, which, you know, ideally you can grow old with your life partner and that shouldn't be a problem. But right. with Alzheimer's, you really need to socialize. And she just, it was like all of her friends were cut off. Mm-hmm. And she just didn't have a lot of interaction or exercise during the day either. And when it came down to healthcare proxy, she wanted my stepfather to remain. And that was difficult because he hates doctors and does not believe in them and did not believe that they were properly doing everything, because he kept being like, doctors, she sees doctors all the time and they're not helping her. And it's like, yeah, well, you took her to the doctor for an ear infection, but that's not the same as helping her Alzheimer's.
Right.
And they hated going to any doctor that was constructive on her Alzheimer's. Like, I was, through a friend, able to talk, get this woman, Dr. Wolf, who's one of the experts in New York State on dementia and Alzheimer's. And she was amazing. And she has this amazing, like, really great outreach helpers and basically just like a social worker. She was just somebody who was in the office to help you and like talk about stuff.
Sure.
And like, she really helped us when things started declining a lot. We would talk to her, and it was just a great office. But my mom and stepfather didn't like her because she told them what was actually happening, and they just never wanted to admit it. Like, it just...
So denial ran... Was it denial that ran strong?
Yeah.
In your mom and her husband?
Yeah. And throughout my whole family, I think. I think I was the only one... Like, I remember when we talked about her finally getting the diagnosis the first time in 2007, and I wasn't somebody who ever drank alone really at that point. Like, I was pretty young in New York. I was in my 20s. I, you know, was always going out with friends and stuff. And I remember I lived next to a tapas place, and I went to the tapas place and I got like a double, I think it was probably whiskey. And at that point I hadn't drank that much whiskey, and I drank so much by myself. And then I came home and I threw up everywhere.
Oh my goodness.
And I always think of, like, you know, nausea is the point of acceptance and understanding, and that they they often say that that's the kind of, you know, philosophical moment where you're really, you know, I realized what my life was going to be, what my mom's life was going to be. And
right.
Yeah, it was a really crazy night. I just remember feeling so ashamed that I drank that much, because I usually didn't and don't.
Right.
And also just so I needed to be numb at that moment, because it was just so real that I was like, my mom as I knew her was never going to be the same.
Right.
And I lost my father pretty young. I lost my father at 16.
Mm-hmm.
So like, she and I were kind of together a lot. So losing her in my early 20s, I couldn't go to her anymore for a lot of stuff because she didn't have the capacity. It hit me very quickly. As soon as I heard, I was kind of like, oh, I'm losing her.
Right. And especially hard because you're the youngest of four, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you weren't, it's not like you were 25 years old, which is still very young,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, you're in your late teens, so...
Yeah.
Right?
When my father passed, yeah.
Yeah. So that's
yeah.
tough. That's tough. At what point did they... Do you think they did acknowledge the reality of her Alzheimer's, either her or yours?
It was that
stepfather.
Appointment that we all went to.
That was the one.
That was the one where she made my brother. We had that. She was going to give us healthcare proxy,
mm-hmm.
and my stepfather talked her out of it,
mm-hmm.
because he kind of, like, my brother got control of her money, which was, we all agreed, was the best.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he had a financial planner. I had a checking account in TD Bank because I think I love the color green, you know, like
right.
I'm not somebody who really knows anything about finance. So he was like, I'll take care of this stuff. And he's always been amazingly above board. I know that's always something that can get very murky, but
mm-hmm.
like, you know, we always used her money to get her the best care possible. Mm-hmm. And even when she passed, like, my brother was just like, there's money for, I set up all the funeral arrangements, and he was just like, do whatever you think is necessary. Mm-hmm. So that was never an issue. But when we sat down after that doctor's appointment, that was when my mom was like, all right, this is what I want and this is what I don't want. And she was really emphatic about wanting a home health care aide. Mm-hmm. I think my stepfather is 11 years older than her. Mm-hmm. And I think she thought that he was going to pass first. Mm-hmm. So she thought she would be alone and she didn't want to go into a home. She kept saying that. And that she wanted us to buy a house and get a health aide for her. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that that's not the best care for someone with Alzheimer's. They really need to be around people and more than one person, really. Like, they have to have more stimulation than that.
Right.
And so we absolutely looked into that when the time finally came, but by the time it came, it was too late. Like, 'cause my stepfather wouldn't allow care into the house. He was her primary care, mm-hmm. and I became more of an advocate. I actually went to court and tried to become my mother's healthcare proxy because we saw that he was unfit, and that came about after Hurricane Sandy hit. And her house was in the flood zone in Long Island, and we tried to get them to escape, and we tried to get them to evacuate. Well, not escape, but evacuate. And my stepfather just didn't want to leave. He didn't think it was going to be that bad because we had had Irene the year before, and a lot of people thought Sandy wasn't going to be that big because Irene was just a lot of wind. It didn't really impact us
right. The
way that Sandy did. And so they lost power. They didn't have heat, and he wasn't getting food into the house. And so my brother drove from Pennsylvania to take them to his home to live with them for a week. And that's when he really saw that, like, she wasn't being properly bathed and her clothing was dirty. And, you know, it was painfully obvious that it's too much, you know.
Right.
Like you said, like, it's really, you need somebody who's really trained to be a caregiver and understands what's going on. Because mm-hmm. I think my stepfather, as someone who doesn't trust medical professionals or the industry at all, or even the study of it, of medicine, he never wanted to learn what was really happening. And I think it's so important to be with somebody with Alzheimer's and understand how to deal with them. Mm-hmm. Like, I could tell my mother was very relaxed when I was with her because they say a lot, you have to yes and people with Alzheimer's. And my sister and I were like, finally, all those improv classes paid off. Because even though she's 12 years older than me, my sister and I both had, you know, quote unquote comedy careers in our lives. And so we actually really enjoyed trying to converse with her because whatever she was saying or whatever she was believing, we were like, yeah, okay. So, or even when she got upset, like, about something that didn't happen, she would... A lot of it was people were against her. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, what should we do if they're against us? What do you want us to do? Like, and what would make you feel safe and all that? Whereas my stepfather would always try and bring logic into it.
Right. Big mistake.
Yeah. And so he kept trying to ground her in reality, and it would make her mm-hmm. even more frustrated. And it wasn't even until close to the end of her life that he finally was telling us all these stories about how she would act out, and she was so angry, and he's like, you don't even know how mean your mother would get. And I'm like, well, and he would give me examples of stories, and I'm like, you're arguing with someone who doesn't understand the reality that you're in. Mm-hmm. So it is horrible for you, and I agree that this is a tragic story for you, but also it's tragic for my mother because she was communicating the way that she knew how in that moment.
Right.
And there was nobody there to give her the proper discussion back. I mean, mm-hmm. at one point he even cut off communication with us because I'm like all over the place with this story. Sorry.
No, this is it. This is what it's like, right?
So
this
Yeah, it's just like it jumps around. But so after the Sandy thing, we actually called, there's child services for adults, basically, mm-hmm. adult services that you can call if you think that an adult is being abused, mm-hmm. who, especially if they have diminished capacity. Mm-hmm. So we went in, and they went there, and they didn't see what we saw. And because we sent somebody in, my stepfather decided to cut off communication with us. Mm-hmm. And I mean, one of the most horrific days of my life was standing outside her house, just trying to get in to see her and talk to her, and just knowing that she was inside and not being able to get to her. And like, just not, my mother was somebody who would mother the world if she could. Mm-hmm. She was so loving. And my mother, no matter how mad she was at me, would never refuse to see me. Mm-hmm. Ever. Like, and so that was one of the most painful days, just seeing, having her shut off completely to me and not being able to get to her, knowing that she needed help.
Right.
So that's when we decided to go for legal help. And it was tragic but true. The lawyer sat down with us and was like, listen, you have a case, but this is what's going to happen. It's going to get to, you know, we're going to go back and forth, and this man's very stubborn, and he is never going to let go of his hold on this, on her and her mm-hmm. health and mm-hmm. his control of it. And it's going to get to a point where your mother's going to be in the hospital, and she's going to get very, very sick, and he's going to have no choice but relinquish her to you. And that's what tragically ended up happening. She got so sick because the caregiving was so not present, the proper mm-hmm. one. Mm-hmm. And it just killed me. I mean, for a long time, I was like, I was fighting so hard to be the caregiver and help her. Mm-hmm. And not being able to do that is just like, I just felt tied up. And, you know, I think a lot of people who have lived with somebody with Alzheimer's in their lives, when they pass away, you're not sad. You're happy that they're free, mm-hmm. you know? And that was something that, like, she wasn't herself for so long. And the person dies slowly, you know? It's a light that fades. A lot of people talk about that and the relationship of Alzheimer's. And you get so disconnected that they pass on before your eyes for years. Mm-hmm. And then when they do finally pass away, you know that there's a peace finally. Mm-hmm.
For them and for you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, especially for her. I mean, I could see her, you know, like the stories of her getting aggravated, the stories of her, I mean, her physical, like the reason that she ended up in the hospital was because she hadn't been urinating or defecating. Mm-hmm. She had been holding it in because, again, with a proper caregiver, they'll be there to assist them in the restroom. Mm-hmm. And as, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with age and, you know, personality and whatnot, but like my stepfather was like, well, she said she was going to the bathroom, so I just believed her. And she wasn't, and she wasn't mm-hmm. eating the proper foods. Mm-hmm. You know, he was like, well, we always have our little treats. And I was like, what's the treats? And it was like, she was eating more Kit Kats than she was vegetables. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, she doesn't want vegetables. And I'm like, but she needs this food to survive. it's interesting because, you know, a lot of people say, like, in life you end up parenting your parents at some point. And it was definitely frustrating because, you know, I'm somebody who, I don't have children, I don't have a husband, mm-hmm. and I have a lot of friends who do. And when at that time in my life, you know, I would sit around with my friends and they would talk about all their defiant children moments, and I'd be like, I know, it's like when I try and get my mom to eat her vegetables and she's not. And like, yeah. Everyone like kind of looked at me like, oh, that's so sad. But that's what it was really trying to get people who, you know, they wanna, and I don't fault, I mean, I'm upset by it, but I get why you want to have your dignity, you want to have your relationships, you want to mm-hmm. keep things the same way. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, this is a disruptive disease that you really have to change your life for. And there's no room for selfishness, and there's no room for ignorance. The more educated, and I mean, it's just amazing to see how some people can live for so long and still have somewhat of a life, you know. I just, it stinks that she didn't get to, you know, sit and make crafts and make mm-hmm. new friends and just kind of go off. But I think he was very scared. A lot of people talk about how people with dementia in these programs end up falling for other people in these programs. And I think he was worried about that too. He was jealous, you know? I think, and I can't speak for him, and I won't, but I think it's just very interesting to, there was animosity between us, but I gave a lot of it up because it is what it is. I wish I could have changed things, and I know that I tried to do everything I could.
It's really a study in letting go. Right?
Absolutely.
You don't have, a caregiver does not, no one on earth has control over everything.
Yeah.
And ultimately you have to surrender to the world that is and the life that is. And even if that means your mother chooses for her husband to have the healthcare proxy, well, that was a choice,
yeah.
right? And you couldn't control that.
Nope.
And you did what you could, and mm-hmm. she has to live with those consequences, even if they're not in, you know, in
yeah.
her best interest. And you have to live with those consequences, even
yeah.
if it's not in your best interest. And it must, I always think of it as kind of like the drug addiction, right?
Mm-hmm.
When someone you love is an addict, there's only so much you can do
yep.
to help them. Ultimately, they have to make decisions on their own.
Yeah.
And you can't force someone to get clean or sober or anything. And you just, in some ways, you have to sit back and watch someone make the wrong choice or suffer from, you know,
yeah.
watch someone suffer. And it's so painful.
Absolutely.
And so I can imagine... Mm-hmm. What it must be like, right, for you to see your mom make a healthcare
yeah.
proxy choice in your mind. I just can see you being like, no.
Well, and it's like even her friends were baffled by that because they like, and that was the thing that I think was also really difficult is there was a lot of things that she started doing that were very out of character for her.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt like they were more in character with what my stepfather would do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that was something that was also upsetting is that we saw her lose her own voice.
Mm-hmm.
And he took over for that voice.
Mm.
And, you know, her best friend, I remember sitting on the phone talking to her and her just being like, why didn't she give one of the, like, why didn't she give one of your kids? And I was like, well, she wanted to be loyal to her husband. And she's like, my husband's my healthcare proxy, but so is my son.
Mm.
You know, like you could have more than one. You need somebody else as a backup, you know? And I mean, it's just one of those things where if it ever comes up in conversation, I feel like I get so passionate and crazed. Like I get like wild eyes, I know. Like when somebody's just like, oh, like healthcare proxy, I'm like, you better pick your healthcare proxy, pick smart, pick it now, pick it while you can. Like I remember one of my bosses saying that she didn't want her husband to have it, but she keeps forgetting to give it to her daughter that she wanted to. And I was like, you have to do that. Like go do it this weekend. It's not that hard. Like it's a paper, it's a sign, like just get it.
Yeah.
Because you never know. And like, even, no matter how old you are, you should have somebody there. Like my case of emergency isn't anybody of my family because nobody lives in the state. It's my best friend because she's a doctor. So I'm just like, yeah, she can be the one that comes and gives everybody else the information. Like,
yeah.
She'll understand what's going on.
So tell me about your mom. What is her name and what was she like?
Her name was Irene.
Irene.
Just like the hurricane. She loved children. She really, really did. She was one of her favorite jobs was being a nursery school teacher. And she was great with kids. She like she had infinite patience.
Mm-hmm.
And she was extremely intelligent. And she would be, if she was here, she would be like, I'm not that smart. But she could pick up a book and like teach herself stuff. So she learned how to do a bunch of computer programming and like computer programs. And she actually went around for NASA BOCES and taught people all around New York State this complex program to keep track of children in this program.
Hmm.
And that was like, she was in her 50s, like, and she taught herself this and traveled around and did this, you know? It always amazed me how she was just one of those people where if she read the instructions on how to do something, she could do that thing.
Hmm.
I mean, she was pretty shy. Like, my family talks about it now. Like, we're a pretty gregarious bunch. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, my sister was an improv person, but there's always that person in the family that's like not theatrical, but is the most theatrical. And my brother Mike is like such a ham. And so we're always people that don't mind being the center of attention, but my mother was not that. She loved to watch everything and just sit back, and she was very giving. And, you know, she enjoyed a Manhattan every night, which I realized when I was an adult, I was like, wow, that was a really strong drink to have every night, Mom. Good for you. But she, you know, she was just a really nice, kind, warm, giving person. And one of the best, I am obviously skewed, but she was an amazing mother. Like, she just taught me so much and really loved me so infinitely.
Do you have a favorite memory?
Oh, man. Watching TV with her, we would cuddle up and watch TV, and just, it's not one moment, it was like 1,000. Because that was really the time that you could talk. My sister says she has teenagers, and she was saying that the best time to talk to a teenager is in the car, because you don't have to make eye contact.
Right, right.
And I feel like that was the same with television. Like, I grew up, you know, in the 80s, and there was all those very special programs.
Right.
So, like, if Blossom was talking about using birth control, we would sit there and she would be like, this isn't a very appropriate topic, but, like, this is what our thoughts are, and blah, blah, blah. And, like, so we would have these moments based on these shows, and it's funny because it's like, oh, well, it seems like such a passive action, but really it was something that we really bonded over and we talked about, and we wouldn't just sit there and stare off. We would have active discussions about the shows that we watched and had really strong opinions.
Yeah, the more you know, it worked on you guys.
Exactly.
That's wonderful. And of course, you then went on to have a career in television.
Yeah.
You run a tell me about your podcast real quick.
So I have a podcast that's on break right now. I have two that are both on break. I have I
Summertime.
Love TV More Than You.
That's which is, I Love TV More Than You.
Yes. Yep. And that's just people come on and talk about their favorite shows and shows that impacted their life. And then I work in television now, like you said. I love it. I work for A&E Networks, and I created and produce PD Stories, which is where officers come on, and it's a spinoff of our show Live PD. And instead of being live, we have officers come and tell crazy stories and monumental stories of their career.
And so, it has a cult following.
Yeah, people really like it. I'm so very, very happy. But, I mean, the live PD audience is also one that's, like, super rabid and loves our show, and they love content around it. But, yeah, we've noticed a lot of people, like, it's got 5-star reviews, and people really, like, when we said it was the season finale, we got more comments than ever, people being like, no, I love it. So,
do you think that part of your love for television is because it was kind of a foundational moment between you and your mom?
100%.
You think so?
I was young. I was below 10, and it was time to go to bed, and I was watching television with my mom, and I was like, no, I didn't see the credits. And she was just like, well, what do you want to see the credits for? I was like, what if my name's in there? My mom was like, no, you have to work on the show for them to put your name. And I was like, well, my name's going to be on there one day. And it hasn't yet, but someday.
Yeah,
I still work in television, which is what I want to do. So, I know she, like, looked at me, and I just remember her being like, you probably will, you know? She was like, it's a lot of work. And I was like, I love working.
Yeah.
Which is true. I started working at like 11.
Yeah. Was she a teacher all her life?
No. So she had a lot of different jobs. She was a secretary when she met my father. Mm-hmm. And then she became a full-time mom. Mm-hmm. And then when I was graduating the nursery school, like at 5, she started working there. Mm. And so I would take the bus from kindergarten. The bus garage was right next to the nursery school, so they would drop me off there, and I would go and help her and go to the nursery school and just see her work. Mm-hmm. And she worked there for a few years and then wanted to get a job that made more money and was more I guess a more adult setting she was looking for. So she went back to being a legal secretary. She worked for a bunch of different attorneys and then decided that she hated attorneys after a while. And so, yeah, she had a bunch of different careers. I bet if she was around, she would say mom was probably her favorite.
Mom.
Yeah.
Right. Of course. And of course, her kids, she must be so proud of. All of her kids.
Yeah.
Right.
We shared a hairdresser. She was a very quirky woman in like Rockville Center that like, she was the kind of hairdresser where you go in and it took like 20 hours to do like a half hour hair dye change. She was very chatty. And she said that my mom would do nothing but brag about her kids. And just to anyone, she would find a way, a hook of talking about how proud of her kids she was. And she really was proud of the people that we became.
And it sounds like you, the four kids, had a pretty good team effort.
Yeah.
There was not a lot of drama or strife in the management of her illness.
No,
right?
I mean, my brother and I really teamed up a lot because he was financial and I was trying to do, I was kind of leading the charge on the legal front. And then my sister was just a rabid researcher. My sister just always wants to like help as much as she can. So we would be on a call and I was like, all right, I'll go do this and I'll go. And my brother's like, all right, I'm going to do that. And my sister's like, and then I'm going to do all the research on what possible things could be outcomes. And I'll do the analytics and this. And she would just like come back with all this information out yeah. us of like what yeah. we, what our choices and options were. And,
yeah.
everything.
And what did you guys do for, obviously your stepfather and your mother both didn't like doctors, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't seek out support,
no.
you know, when, if they didn't have to. What did the four of you do to get the support that you needed?
We leaned a lot on each other, mm-hmm. I think, but I think we all kind of had our own things. You know, my sister is one of those people that has finished her bucket list and has a new bucket list and just always writing. She's an amazing writer. And Mike just really threw himself into work. He had a couple of tough years in work. So, yeah, I think we were just Funks love to work.
mm-hmm.
And so we threw ourselves into our jobs a lot. Probably not the healthiest of ways.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the only one that goes to regular therapy.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I live in New York City, so it's like kind of part
you
of
have to.
Yeah,
yeah,
like here's your keys, here's your here's the card for the therapist, here you go,
here's
welcome
your
to New York
Metro card. Yeah. And the name of your therapist. Yeah,
yeah. The R train's the best to cry on, good luck.
Yeah.
You know, like, but no, I mean, I definitely relied on therapy during those years, and
yeah.
then I took what I learned and helped my siblings.
Yeah. Did it, at any point did you guys ever consider seeking out a support group for caregivers or family caregiving classes or anything like that?
Not really, because our situation was such that we felt as though no one would get it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and it's interesting though, because our social worker kept saying, this is so common.
Mm.
You are not alone. This is not an issue that just you guys have. And they encouraged us, but I think we were just so focused on helping her
right.
that we didn't take that. And then that's something, right. if I could go back, I wish I had gone to one of those
mm-hmm.
groups. But I think at that time in my life, anything for me felt like it was taking time away to fight for her. You know, I was like, all right, I'll keep myself alive, food, water, shelter, I'll have my job,
right.
and I'll do a great job at my job, and then I will just do everything I can to make sure that she is safe. And that was, like, something that really weighed on me. It was, like, I felt very much like a mother with a child in danger.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, you know, stay up nights just being, like, I know she's not safe there. You know, especially after Hurricane Sandy, we knew things were really, really bad. And I worried that she was going to get hurt. I worried that she was going to burn down the house. I worried, you know, my stepfather kept leaving her alone a lot. And at her stage, she couldn't be left alone.
Right.
And so I was just so worried that she would hurt herself and not know what to do. And, you know, there was a lot of discussion of more, what can we do to help her, than I think more than what can we do to help us.
Right. Now that it's been about a year since mm-hmm. she's passed away, how is your relationship with your stepfather? Has it changed at all? Do you talk anymore? Has it improved? Has it gotten worse?
I don't think it could go worse than legal action. But I don't think he ever understood. And he thinks that we were dopey, and he thinks that we're headstrong. And he often thinks that we think we're smarter than him. Mm-hmm. And that would always frustrate me, because there's different levels of intelligence. I don't think I'm smarter than anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, I probably have better logic and reasoning, but he has spatial relations for days of understanding that I don't.
Yeah.
So I was always trying to work to educate, and he did not like that.
Right.
You know, for a few months after her death, I really tried to keep up the connection. But because he never took any ownership of the fact that she really got sicker and quicker because of his reluctance to get a full-time caregiver, because he just didn't want anybody in the house. Like, there were people that actually came in and were like, you need somebody in the house. And there were stipulations that basically we finally did get some legal stipulations of, like, you have to keep the house stocked. There's going to be somebody who comes in, a neutral third party that checks on her. And there's going to be a nurse to sit with her, so that way you can go out. Because they finally explained to him, well, the court had to explain to him that, like, you can't do this by yourself. This isn't, no one can. It's right. not a you yeah. thing. And that was the thing that was
it's
so difficult.
It's an everybody thing.
Yeah, like he yeah. really took it personally. Like, I was like, you're an idiot, you can't do this. When it's really like, no, literally, like, even the most trained professionals cannot do this on right. their own. They need relief. They need somebody else to come in. So he just was so angry that we did that. And he's just not super nice to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I was at the house trying to just get some belongings because he was talking about trying to clean up some clutter. And I was like, oh, there's some just items of hers that I wanted to keep for sentimental reasons. Mm-hmm. And her wedding dress that she wore to marry him was there. And he said something like, oh, yeah, we'll save it for when Taylor gets married, who's my niece. And I was like, okay, so we're not going to. I'm never getting married. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was just, there was always little slights like that towards me about, he just didn't never like the fact that I am, you know, what he would call a career woman instead of a wife. Mm-hmm. And I gave my mom so much stress because I didn't have anybody to take care of me, which I know was partially true. But also I remember my mom seeing my friends and my friend support group in New York and just always being like, you have so many people, mm. you know, you've always been somebody who has a lot of friends around you.
Yeah,
there's just a personality clash that I was kind of, mm-hmm. I wanted to, for my mom, take care of him and just check on him. And I tried for a couple of months, and then it just started giving me anxiety. I'm going to have to hear he was upset that he didn't get to spend more time with her at the mm-hmm. end, because when she did get so sick that she had to go into the hospital, we finally got her into a Pennsylvania care, a home in Pennsylvania for care. Mm. And we decided Pennsylvania because it's actually really great care for a much more affordable price than New York State. Mm-hmm. And my brother and sister-in-law are teachers, and they have a schedule where they could check in on her more.
So a lot of good reason
yeah.
for moving to Pennsylvania.
Yeah, right? It wasn't, but he felt like we were trying to punish him.
Right.
Whereas it was really the best for her care because, you know, we looked at places in New York and we talked about, you know, fine, I would get a car so that way I could go and drive out to, you know, Plainview or wherever and go visit her. And I was just like, this is going to be too much. And whereas we can afford this facility that's beautiful, that knows how to meet her needs and has several caregivers around the clock. And, you know, he just thought it was them that killed her. They oh, right. they're, that's what those places are. I saw on TV, that's what they do. And it's like, no, like, she fell while she was there. And he was just like, what happened there? And I was like, she tripped over a chair. And he was like, well, I don't believe it. Why weren't they watching her? Well, because it's just like watching children. You can't,
right.
you're watching 10 kids in a room, you turn your back for 1 second, one trips over a chair and hurts themselves, it's not your fault.
Right.
It's what happens.
Yes, it's the nature of the illness and it's the nature of the age and all that stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was just, you know, I just didn't want to hear that I did something wrong because
right.
you already blame yourself. You know, I think it's just something that, I mean, I don't know,
right.
maybe it's being raised Catholic or whatever, but like, you know, I just always felt guilt about everything, but
right.
I didn't want to feel guilt about doing something that I knew was right for her.
Right.
And I don't want to argue about it anymore, you know, like.
Do you still feel guilty?
I think my guilt has gotten a lot better. Because when my mom passed, like, people would be like, you did so much, you did. And I was like, no, nope, didn't. And now that I've gotten some time from that situation, and, like, I think even my siblings and I have really kind of sat with it and been like, wow, we did it. Like, when we got her into the Pennsylvania home, my brother, my sister, and I all drove her, and we sat at his kitchen table and just, like, had this, like, cuddle hug of like, we did it, and we're, you know, it was all that fighting and we finally got her in a safe place, and that felt great. But after a year, do I still feel guilt? Not as much. I think I'll always wish that I pushed harder for certain things, but in my mind I know even if somebody has Alzheimer's, they still have free will because they are humans, and you can't take away someone's right to choose, especially when it comes to healthcare.
Right.
So that was her choice, and I had to respect it. And I definitely still feel guilt. I think I haven't totally processed her passing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I am like her in a way where, you know, just never stop moving. Just keep going.
Right.
So, I mean, people were like, you went back to work a week after. And I'm like, yeah, because what am I going to do? Sit around and be sad?
Right.
But then a month after, I had to call out of work because I could not stop crying.
Yeah.
I literally hysterical cried for like 24 hours straight. And it wasn't even like something sad that happened or just an onflux. It was like my body was just like, oh my God, like this is so sad, this loss. But I think it is, like I was saying earlier, that like lead up to it where you mourn someone for a very long time. I mourned my mom's passing for a decade as I watched it. And so in some ways, when I think about her not being with us anymore, I'm happy because I think that, you know, I'm not a super religious person, but I think in the spiritual world, she's who she is and she's with me and, you know, she loves me. And I actually feel more connected to her now that she's passed than those last few years, because those last few years, I was a mother to her. I was holding her hand. I was, you know, wiping her butt. You know, it's a disease that really, it infantiles the person.
Right.
I don't think that's a word, but still. It makes them.
Infantilizes.
There we go.
Yes.
And, you know, you don't feel the mother-daughter relationship. It's juxtaposed. So I miss her, but I think I was so sad for so long that there's a feeling of a lot of relief. And you feel guilt because you feel relieved because you want that person there. But my mom wasn't there. You know, like there were a lot of things that I needed a mom for during those times in my 20s, you know, job changes.
Sure.
You know, boy stuff. Just regular life stuff, changing apartments and, you know, moving around and
cooking and,
yeah,
you know,
just like,
you know,
silly
mom stuff.
Just like, you know, oh, we're like, sometimes I find myself, and not too much, but like sometimes I'll find myself really jealous when people are like, oh, I'll just call my mom and ask her. And I'm just like, you get to call your mom and ask her that?
Yeah.
Like, come on.
How do you feel like you are a different person? Obviously, this is this was a 10-year process, right? So a person changes on their own over the course of 10 years. But if you were to name one way in which you've changed, in what way would you say that you have changed? If at all. Some people, you know, some people don't.
No, I think my perspective definitely changed. my wardrobe changed, actually.
How's that?
So when we started the legal proceedings, I was somebody who wore ripped concert t-shirts and jeans every day. Uh-huh. And, you know, like old Chucks and whatever, you know, like I was kind of like a grunge kid still in my, even in my early 30s, I was doing, like, that's when we started. And I worked at Viacom, which is like MTV, VH1, TV Land.
So
was
you fit
like,
right in.
Yeah. So yeah. It was like a place where like you didn't really, you don't have a corporate look there. And that's one of the selling points of working there. And I loved it.
Yeah.
And then I had to be prepared to go into a lawyer's office and defend my mother. And I was like, oh, I have to look like a real adult.
So suddenly you're like at Ann Taylor Loft.
Yeah. I was like, I was at like New York & Co. and just finding all these tailored dresses and ways to look put together as quick as possible.
Yeah.
And so now I wear dresses all the time. I'm always overdressed for occasions, I feel like. And that's something that I noticed only recently, because someone was like, oh, you know, Sue's always so dressed up. And I was like, I am not. Oh, I am now.
You got that lawyer look and you love
yes.
it.
I got this like.
I love it.
I got this because I was trying so hard to be clean cut and look like someone who has their life together that I actually became somebody who is clean cut and has their life together. the ruse became reality.
I love it. That's a podcast right there.
Yes.
Oh my, fake it till you make it.
And then the other thing that I think changed in terms of perspective is we didn't get everything in that legal fight, but it really taught me that you're not always going to win the big battle, but the little battles are worth fighting. And, you know, I really trust my gut. It taught me that even if people are like, this is ridiculous, you're never going to win, you fight for it. You fight for the people that you love for. I fought for my mom, and I would fight for any of my family members and friends.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it just really made me realize that, you know, in my life, I've had a lot of battles and I've had a lot of craziness.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it makes life so much better, because I think you have to have really horrible low points to appreciate the good. I think I have a really good perspective on, like, my sister-in-law recently said, she's like, you're the happiest, most content person I know. And I mean, I live in New York. Things drive me crazy. There's a slow walker. The train broke down. Yeah. But I'm happy with life because I've gone through these sad moments that were really horrible and I was always tense. And now I just realize how precious life is. I'm going to enjoy every minute of it. And every moment that's not horrible, I'm going to be happy for. And I think that, you know, the process of going through everything with my mom really made me realize how it's just better to be present and happy than worry.
If you have one piece of advice to give someone who mm-hmm. is new to the caregiving process, what would your advice be?
There's so much. I'm like, I've got 1,000 things that I'm like, this is what you need to do. But I think probably take care of yourself and remember to put your own oxygen mask on first, you know. And just patience. The whole thing is really tough. So just have patience.
Good advice. Sue Funk, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to share your story, go to caringkindnyc.org/podcast. Maybe we'll use your story on the show. We'd love to hear from you. Please subscribe to this podcast and leave some glowing feedback. We love positive reinforcement. I'm Chris Doucette, and you're listening to Caregiver Storyteller, produced by Caring Kind, the heart of Alzheimer's caregiving.